Hi, I'm Marco Werman. All of us in the newsroom are used to being on deadline, and right now is no exception. We are officially in the home stretch before our fundraiser ends on June 30th. Many listeners in the last few weeks have responded with words of encouragement and, yes, financial support. I can't tell you how much it means to all of us. Take this note from a listener named Phyllis. Thank you so much for your creation and contributions, she writes. A huge contribution to world understanding. Much needed. Thank you, and warm good wishes. Thank you so much, Phyllis. Join Phyllis and so many other listeners by going to theworld.org/give and make your gift today. Time is running out before June 30th, so please don't wait. That's theworld.org/give, or check out the link in our episode notes. Thank you again, and be well.
In Moscow, you can't call the fight in Ukraine a war, and with no formal declaration, there's no conscription.
They don't have enough forces in order to replace all the losses they've taken.
So the Russian military is turning to piecemeal solutions. And Germany is sending weapons to Ukraine. That leaves many wary of getting pulled into that conflict.
We have been involved in two wars. I think it's enough. For me, it's enough. We can be Switzerland.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, pumpkin toadlets. Tiny and as adorable as that name suggests.
They're cute frogs. They're just adorable.
But they can't do one quintessentially froggy thing. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. Thanks for being with us today. The first delivery of heavy weapons from Germany arrived in Ukraine this week. It marks the end to a long-standing German policy not to send lethal aid into active conflict zones. Germany also plans to modernize its own military in response to the war in Ukraine. In a country where history looms large, many Germans are uneasy with these changes and with Germany's new proximity to war. The World's Carolyn Beeler spoke to people across Germany to get a sense of how they're feeling.
Sehr geehrte Frau Präsidentin.
3 days after Russia invaded Ukraine, Chancellor Olaf Scholz told the German parliament that the European continent had reached a turning point.
Markiert eine Zeitenwende in der Geschichte unseres Kontinents.
The word he used, Zeitenwende, is a strong one, indicating the end of an era.
Dass Deutschland der Ukraine Waffen zur Verteidigung des Landes liefern wird.
Scholz said Germany would supply weapons to Ukraine, reversing a decades-long policy and dividing German public opinion. Alex Hoberg, who works at a hospital in western Germany, is among those who's worried about supplying arms and training Ukrainian soldiers.
I fear that this will be an active participation of the war, I think, and then it can come as well here. We have been involved in two wars. I think that's enough. For me, it's enough. We can be Switzerland.
The specter of Germany's role as an aggressor in two world wars looms large here. So does the more recent memory of nuclear threats during the Cold War. This week, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that an intercontinental ballistic missile with nuclear capabilities would be deployed by the end of the year. It could easily reach Germany.
The possibility of a nuclear war was far from us over the last 30 years, and now it has come close again.
Karsten Atta is a fruit farmer in western Germany.
This is something of concern, of course. I'm feeling less secure, but I'm not afraid. In case we have to fight, we will fight.
In response to the war being waged some 500 miles away, Germany is beefing up its own defenses. Humboldt University historian Martin Lutz says that's after decades of underinvestment.
To put it more bluntly, I think there are very good reasons to say that Germany has been free riding on the security infrastructure, for example, established by NATO.
Germany now plans to pump 100 billion euros into the military this year alone and finally meet the NATO target of spending 2% of its GDP on defense. That's something it hasn't done since the end of the Cold War. Lutz says the country's emergency preparedness systems have also fallen into what he calls neglect and decline.
The infrastructure for the protection of civilians is in a very bad shape.
The number of emergency sirens working today is down to a fraction of the Cold War figure. Same for nuclear fallout shelters. And it's not clear how many of those that still exist would actually protect anybody since the government stopped maintaining them in 2007. One of those former fallout shelters was completed in a Berlin subway station in 1977.
And now coming to the platform.
Tour guide Kai Heine shows me around.
So if this will be used as a shelter, then about 2,000 people will sleep here on four-level bunk beds.
Down a long hallway behind a locked door at the end of the subway platform, the one-time shelter is an accidental museum to the Cold War era.
This is the way to the kitchen.
There's a fully stocked kitchen, bathrooms, and an infirmary crowded with bunk beds and sheets still in their plastic wrapping.
The linens are just piled here, never been touched since it was bought in here in 1977 when they finished the bunker.
Heine says the tour company he works for has gotten lots of calls recently, not just from tourists, but from locals asking where they can find their closest bunker. The Federal Disaster Assistance Office, too, says calls from concerned citizens and requests for its guidebook on emergency preparedness have spiked.
The threat of war coming from the east is now more clear for everybody.
Since the Russian war started, the government has suspended the decommissioning program for bunkers. It's also upped spending for medical equipment stockpiles, emergency tents, generators, and the like.
This is a turning point for many, many people, I think. I don't like the idea, but perhaps you have to spend a lot more money for the militaries. It's like this old saying, if you seek for the peace, prepare for the war.
The government's Disaster Assistance Office recently launched a new webpage urging citizens to buy non-perishable foods and prepare a go bag. None of the Germans I talked to said they were doing any of this yet, but most talked about a new sense of unease. Andre Pfeiffer remembers learning to take cover from atomic bombs at a boys' military training camp in the former East Germany. But he says this war feels a lot more real to him.
In the 80s, it was much more in the papers and the news, but there was no difference in life. Today, it's much more our own life, like we see the empty shelves in the shops and the Ukrainian refugees in the streets of Berlin. So it's much more feelable.
Right now, his main worries are rising fuel prices and the future of the economy. Those are concerns shared by many Germans, and likely exacerbated today, as Berlin announced it's one step closer to rationing natural gas in response to reduced supplies from Russia. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Afghanistan's Taliban government is pleading for international aid after a massive earthquake in the remote southeast region of the country flattened entire villages. More than 700 people have been killed, and countless are homeless and in desperate need of aid. Some supplies are beginning to trickle into the quake-hit zone, and Western aid groups are among those providing relief. But many in the West are loath to work alongside the Taliban's ultra-conservative government. Susanna George, the Kabul bureau chief for The Washington Post, was in the quake-struck region of Paktika earlier today. She's now on the road heading back to Kabul. Susanna, what are the images that are seared in your mind from what you've seen over the past 24 hours?
Yeah, I think it would be the stories from civilians of frantically digging their loved ones out of the rubble by hand. We spoke to one woman who said she felt like she had to make a choice between saving her children and her mother. Both were buried. She wasn't able to get to her children in time, and she described hearing their screams fading away.
Oh, God, it's just devastating. What sort of help do people have there in trying to rescue loved ones?
Everyone that we've spoken to said that they rescued their loved ones, the ones that just survived, with their own hands and with the help of neighbors, with the help of people from neighboring villages, the mosques in the area set out announcements after the earthquake occurred, encouraging people to go to certain villages that were hardest hit.
What sort of aid has arrived at this point?
In terms of aid, aid has slowly been returning to Afghanistan for months now. The UN has staffed back up a while ago. Other groups, aid groups have returned. Mainly, this was in response to fears of famine over the winter. So, yeah, there are these organizations that are on the ground in Paktika, where we were, in the district of Gayan. But from what we saw, and this was really just a sliver of the bigger picture, there was not organized aid distributions or anything like that yet. Some NGOs were helping transport wounded to the hospitals. Others, including the Taliban, were conducting assessments mainly, gathering information about how many houses were destroyed, how many people were killed, numbers like that.
Any sign of the kinds of humanitarian organizations that usually show up for these things or can show up, like Doctors Without Borders or International Red Cross, any of those organizations there yet?
This quake did hit a very large part of eastern Afghanistan. We saw a small part of that today. We did see International Red Cross vehicles. We saw some UN vehicles. Those were the vehicles that were helping transport the injured to the hospital.
What are the most urgent things that are needed at this point?
Everyone who we spoke to said the most urgent things that they need are tents, because they're too scared to, even if their houses are just partially destroyed, they're too fearful to return to their homes and sleep there during the night. And this is a part of the country that it's very cold at night.
The Taliban government is asking for international aid to help with this natural disaster. They're begging nations, Western nations, to help. But are governments likely to give money now? I mean, Western governments don't want to give money directly to the Taliban. Is your sense that countries are sticking to their previous policy of not giving money directly to the Taliban government?
For months now, countries that do not have formal diplomatic relations with the Taliban have been giving money to the Afghan people. They've been doing this through other organizations, so they're not giving the money to the Taliban government. They're giving money either through the UN or other NGOs that are on the ground that operate independently. And that is how we would expect that money that would help this natural disaster recovery would flow into the country.
How has the Taliban government responded to this crisis? What are they able to mobilize to help?
I do believe it's a bit early to answer this question definitively, but what we do know from past Taliban responses to crises, and I'm specifically thinking about the hunger crisis in Afghanistan, is that they don't excel at the logistical side of aid distribution. And so that's something that I'll be watching closely in the days ahead.
If I can ask, how has the Taliban dealt with reporters like you who are covering this crisis?
We had a very smooth reporting trip, but any statement like that from a female American journalist working for the Washington Post needs to come with a really large caveat. The fact that I am a foreign journalist and that I work for a well-known Western news organization affords me a lot of privilege that Afghan journalists do not have. So the fact that I was treated respectfully by members of the Taliban and that we were given pretty good access to places that were hit by the earthquake doesn't mean that all journalists received that same treatment. But if conditions do deteriorate in eastern Afghanistan and resentment of the Taliban builds there, I wouldn't be surprised if access to all journalists is severely restricted in the weeks and months ahead.
The Taliban are calling on the Biden administration to release Afghan assets held in U.S. banks. Is that likely to happen, or do you hear that from the Taliban in Afghanistan, that demand?
I've certainly heard the demand from the Taliban in Afghanistan. The Biden administration did already unfreeze half of those assets. Those assets have not been distributed yet. So I don't know if there's been any talk about using that half of the unfrozen assets for this disaster recovery relief effort. But when the Biden administration unfroze these assets, they were unfrozen specifically to be used to help the Afghan people. What I do know about the United States is that we've seen statements that the U.S. says that it is already aiding in recovery efforts through intermediaries.
Susanna George is the Afghanistan and Pakistan bureau chief for the Washington Post. She was in the quake-struck region of Paktika earlier today. She's now on the road back to Kabul. Up next, Russia hasn't declared war on Ukraine, so it can't institute a draft.
The Russian military is trying to hire personnel, and the way they're doing that is first and foremost by trying to offer significant amounts of money.
and by mobilizing in the occupied territories. That's coming up. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In Russia, calling the invasion of Ukraine a war could land you in prison. Russian officials prefer the term special military operation. That label also has implications on the battlefield. Since Russia has not officially declared war on Ukraine, it has also not conducted a mass mobilization of troops. We're joined now by Michael Kaufman. He directs the Russia Studies Program at the Center for Naval Analyses. Michael, who are the Russian troops who are conducting this war in Ukraine?
So Russia's fielding a mix of regular troops from its forces. It's using a lot of mobilized units from the Luhansk and Donetsk People's Republics. These are the sort of breakaway enclaves that it's been supporting and has recognized. It's also employing a lot of auxiliaries from different parts of Russian security forces. Rosguardia, which is Russian National Guard, it's using a lot of Chechen units. And as the Russian military has taken pretty significant losses, particularly in the first part of this war, it's increasingly been relying on newly hired contract servicemen, volunteers, and almost anybody else that they could dragoon into replacement units.
Now, as Russia's military sustains casualties, are reservists being sent in to fill in the gaps?
So the Russian military really was not optimized or designed for this kind of war. It was built more for a short, sharp war. And because of that, the force structure that is the forces they had available, a lot of them got used up pretty quickly. Now it's increasingly relying on what are so-called reserve battalions, which are units formed with newly hired personnel and what's left of the current sort of military back at their bases. And they're trying to roll reservists into contract service. This is significant in Russia because they've not declared a state of war, which means they are not employing conscripts or trying to avoid it, and they cannot conduct a general mobilization, and they cannot enact stop-loss policies, the kind of policies where they keep servicemen from ending their tours of duty or breaking their contract.
You've used the term shadow mobilization to describe what Russia's doing. What does that mean?
Yeah, so in effect, behind the scenes, the Russian military is trying to hire personnel and to fill out additional units. And the way they're doing that is first and foremost by trying to offer significant amounts of money and by essentially trying to hire up contract servicemen. They're trying to call in those with prior military experience into what are called voyenkomats. These are essentially recruitment offices. And when they appear, they offer them funding in order to try to get them to sign up. And they're also trying to get folks to form volunteer battalions wherever they can to send them on the battlefield. Plus, they have been mobilizing across the occupied territories in Ukraine. That said, they don't have enough forces in order to replace all the losses they've taken in the first 3 months of the war. And they also don't have sufficient forces in order to rotate the current units that are fighting in Ukraine off of the line. So what they're essentially pursuing are piecemeal solutions. This will allow them to kick the can down the road, so to speak, and retain staying power on the battlefield. But the problems in the Russian military are structural when it comes to a lack of personnel and a lack of force availability. And trying to continue to frame this as a special operation simply continues to exacerbate those problems. That is, the Russian approach is not sustainable if this becomes a protracted war.
Is Russia also pulling from its officer corps to fill in the gaps?
Absolutely, but this exhausts the officers available. So in forming additional reserve battalions, the Russian military ends up over time using up what officers and enlisted professionals are available in the force. They are needed to train conscripts that are freshly arrived, and the equipment they use is also needed to train personnel. So what happens over time is that you have a general degradation of the Russian military. In effect, they're somewhat cannibalizing parts of the force to sustain this war, and that's why I don't believe long-term these solutions are sustainable for them.
You've called the war in Ukraine an artillery war, basically a war of attrition. What do you mean by that?
This war is one where most of the damage being done and most of the casualties being inflicted, and the decisive factor is the employment of artillery and, to a lesser extent, air power. But artillery is doing most of the damage and most of the killing in this conflict. And it's become principally a war of attrition. right? If you think of the early phase of the conflict with Russian forces driving in, trying to rapidly seize terrain, is essentially a conflict based on maneuver. But now, in the second phase, and for the last 2 months or even more, it's very clear that neither side has the forces to rapidly seize terrain, to exploit breakouts, to conduct big maneuvers, or to turn flanks. So essentially, it is a war of attrition, where both sides engage in extensive artillery fire. Then, once the opponent's force is degraded sufficiently, they move up, take some territory incrementally, and then repeat the cycle again and again. This is a war that's essentially being fought with artillery firepower, and you don't see a lot of territory changing hands, and you don't see tremendous advances by either side, but it is inflicting tremendous amount of damage to the force itself. That is, you have a lot of casualties, but little territory changing hands.
Is Ukraine's military suited to counter this type of warfare?
So Ukraine is also using a primarily artillery army. The challenge Ukraine has had in recent months is that they run incredibly low on ammunition. And now they're trying to make a transition to using Western equipment and Western artillery, where munitions can be readily resupplied. So they're probably in one of the most difficult periods of the conflict, where they're attempting to make this great transition. Ukraine's military is also exhausted. It's taking tremendous amounts of casualties, especially in the last 2 months. Overall, Ukraine does enjoy a long-term military advantage because they have the manpower, they have the personnel, and they have potentially access to a sustained supply of Western equipment. But that entirely depends on the extent of military support Ukraine gets over time. This is highly conditional on political decisions, on availability of Western military aid, and so on. In the interim period, both sides are likely to get exhausted in the coming months because the rate of casualties they've had are principally unsustainable, at least from my point of view. To what extent can Ukraine itself conduct a substantial counteroffensive or engage in maneuver warfare later on? That really remains to be seen.
As this war stretches into a war of attrition, can you imagine an operational pause, and what might that look like?
Yeah, I think that's quite likely. Both sides are probably going to need a refit. They're going to need to resupply their units. An operational pause will still involve fighting and dynamic exchanges of territory on the margins. So you're still going to have artillery duels taking place. But it'll also be clear that neither side has the strength to conduct any significant offensives. And so that might be a period that comes within months or later this year. But again, that's not going to be one that defines the future course of this war. It's not going to be an established stalemate, nor is the conflict likely to freeze. Both sides are probably going to use that time period to try to rearm and replace their losses.
So you don't think an operational pause could create an opening for negotiation and potential full-fledged ceasefire?
I'm deeply skeptical of that proposition.
Michael Kaufman is the director of the Russia Studies Program at the Center for Naval Analyses. He's been speaking with us about the makeup of Russian forces in Ukraine. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on your program.
More stories from around the globe are just ahead. You're listening to The World. COVID has kept Chinese tourists at home. That's being felt across Southeast Asia. I want them back, says this restaurant owner in Bangkok, as tourism opens up again. She's even promising a new menu. And Dua Lipa's music festival is back on in Kosovo. I'm Carol Hills. That and more coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Before the pandemic, no country sent more tourists abroad than the People's Republic of China. But don't expect to see travelers from mainland China anytime soon. They're grounded under strict COVID containment rules. Their absence is being most painfully felt in Southeast Asia, where many shops are desperate for Chinese travelers and their money to return. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports from Bangkok.
I'm gazing longingly into a giant vat of soup. It smells amazing. This peppery broth is ladled into a bowl, then dumplings are added, and finally, the ingredient that gave this tiny restaurant its fame.
So the famous thing about this restaurant is the fish ball.
Yes, homemade fresh fish ball, every day.
Tipawan likit am nuepon. opened this shop more than 30 years ago. It's called Piranha, located in a busy part of Bangkok. Piranha has always done well, but about 10 years back, Tipawan noticed there are a lot of Chinese tourists in here, kind of suddenly. One of them explained, "Oh, your soup? It's recommended in a famous Chinese guidebook." I asked Tipawan how she reacted.
Kun Tipawan rusuk yangai kap?
Tokje le di jai ma ka. Kai nen nam lo ko ma, lo po ma lo ko.
Shocked, she said, but thrilled. It felt gratifying. Getting popular with Chinese tourists can put your business on steroids. Soon they were lining up to taste her soup and homemade fish balls, which are meatballs made of fish. Across Southeast Asia, there are many stories like this. Family businesses transformed by Chinese visitors. Before COVID, those visitors were already a pillar of the region's tourism economy.
I know that many in the industry, they're very, very eager to welcome Chinese visitors back.
Stephen Chapani is a tourism expert with Asian Development Bank. He says the nature of Chinese travel has changed a lot. It used to be mostly big group tours, and they didn't spend a lot of money.
In the early stages, you tend to see group tourists. I'll use the cliche of there's someone leading everybody around wearing the same hat, holding up a flag.
But in the past decade or so, thanks to rising incomes in China, more travelers come as families or as couples or even solo.
Much, much smaller groups, you know, looking for more experiences, not just taking photos in front of iconic destinations.
On average, Chinese travelers spend $1,800 per trip, more than Americans. Chapani says in 2019, 1 in 5 tourists coming to Southeast Asia were Chinese. The region is affordable, tropical, and it's a quick flight from Shanghai or Beijing. For a while there, it seemed like Chinese travelers would be a permanent fixture of the economy here. Tipawan, the restaurateur in Bangkok, even learned a few Chinese phrases. I got brave enough to say hello in Chinese, she says, and learn words for different types of noodles. Then COVID came and customers vanished. The difference is, Tipawan now sees everyone else coming back to her restaurant, everyone but the Chinese. Chapani, the tourism expert, does predict Chinese tourism spending will eventually return and exceed what it was before COVID.
I think we'll continue to see growth from that market once things start to, I guess we'll say, normalize after COVID.
But when will that be? So far, Beijing gives no indication it will allow Chinese citizens to freely travel anytime soon. Chinese tourists were spending more than $250 billion per year on worldwide travel. That's equivalent to the entire GDP of Portugal that's right now missing from the global economy. In Thailand, which is the favorite destination for mainland Chinese travelers, the tourism industry is struggling to come back to life without them. Now, Tipawan's soup shop, Piranha, is doing fine, but oh, how she misses her Chinese customers. I want them back. Come back and eat up, she says. I'll even roll out a special menu just for you. For the world, this is Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
These days, it seems like we're short on lots of things. Baby formula, sriracha sauce, and workers, to name a few. And now, pilots. American Airlines announced this week it's dropping service to 3 U.S. cities because of a pilot shortage. Why? Well, we turn to Patrick Smith, a pilot and the host of AskThePilot.com, to find out. Patrick, why the pilot shortage?
Well, there's the big picture pilot shortage, and then there's the more immediate pilot shortage. When we look at the more immediate one, we're talking in the context of all the chaos and confusion and delays and cancellations and all the stuff that's going on right now this summer. And a lot of that goes back to the pandemic and how airlines handled staffing during the height of COVID. And a lot of crews were put on no-fly status or in some cases furloughed entirely. Now they're being brought back, but airline training departments are backlogged and it's just not happening at a pace that's keeping up with the demand.
And is what you're talking about in the U.S. context or is that a global issue as well?
It's both, but primarily right now it's a U.S. issue.
And the larger issue?
The pay and working conditions at the regional sector of the industry were so poor that eventually the pool of pilots and applicants just dried up. People just weren't willing anymore to get into the industry because the reward was so poor. And so people stopped getting into the business. And so the pilot pool dried up.
I'm curious, in Europe, many airlines have training programs for would-be pilots. In the U.S., I understand they don't. Would that make a difference here?
Overseas, we see a lot of what we call ab initio programs, where pilots are brought into an airline with basically no experience at all, or very little, and are groomed and trained from the ground up, so to speak. Whereas in the U.S., the vast majority of pilots apply at an airline already trained and already experienced. However they get that experience is a different story. But we're seeing U.S. airlines now at least talking about getting into similar programs. That's one way of dealing with this, but it's a long-term approach. It's not something that's going to solve the issue in the next 6 months.
For you as a pilot, does this environment make your job more stressful?
It does. And the things that stress me out and make my job more difficult are the same things that make, you know, the passengers stressed out and makes travel more difficult for them. Delays, cancellations, long lines, chaos at the airport, and so forth.
Are there any quick fixes that airlines can do to smooth things out this summer?
Well, they're trying. Airlines are preemptively canceling flights, adjusting their schedules a little more rationally to account for the demand and staffing levels. But I don't see things getting drastically better until demand drops off after Labor Day.
Are there countries, say, in Europe or some other part of the world where things are just going swimmingly and you plan a trip and get on the plane, everything's going well?
Right now, I would say no. It's worldwide, though it's definitely worse in some areas than others. The U.S. domestic sector right now probably has it worse than anywhere else, but Europe is also pretty bad.
How do you see this current crisis of not enough pilots affecting the travel industry going forward?
Well, to be clear, the crisis that we're in now isn't simply a matter of there not being enough pilots. It's there not being enough workers across all aspects of the industry right now. And how that will affect travel. Demand is very high right now. There are more people traveling right now than ever before. So at the moment, it's not having an effect on demand. If the situation were to stay the way it is long term, then we can talk about whether or not it's dissuading people from traveling.
So you're a pilot, you fly domestically and internationally. Which are the better flights?
International flying tends to be a little less hectic, more predictable. Flights tend to leave when they're supposed to, though not always, but it's more reliable flying than domestic flying. There are fewer moving parts, and for airlines, international flights are high priority. They make a lot of revenue, especially from the business class cabins and carrying cargo. It's important to get those flights out.
Patrick Smith is a pilot, and he hosts the AskThePilot.com website. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The earthquake in Afghanistan is the most immediate crisis facing people there. At the end of last summer, there was another one, the withdrawal of American forces, which unleashed an exodus of refugees from Afghanistan who are still finding pathways to resettle in safer countries. This is World Refugee Week, and so we reached out to the leader of the State Department's Refugee Resettlement Program to learn how the U.S. is responding not only to Afghan refugee needs, but people from other global regions, too. Holly Herrera is Domestic Resettlement Chief of the Office of Refugee Admission. I asked her what she thinks Americans don't understand about the refugee process.
Every human being has the right to seek safety. And the refugees who come to this country are so thoroughly vetted and screened before they come here. And when they arrive, they are very, very quickly in the workplace. They are contributing to their communities. And refugees have taken many of the jobs that really are left open, such as meatpacking, for example, or some very entry-level jobs. Even those refugees who come in, such as many of the Afghans, with credentials, with English, have to start over again. And they do. And they come here so that they can live in freedom and their children will be able to grow up in safety and freedom.
In the case of the Afghan refugees who you've been resettling, how do you find homes for them?
In terms of the services, we have so many wonderful community groups that are involved in supporting at the local level resettlement of Afghans and other refugee populations. They will commit to doing everything from meeting refugees at the airport to helping them get set up in their first home, to find that first job, to have someone that they can meet and learn about life in the United States.
The refugee resettlement program often gets drawn into politics. Describe how the size of the program changed from the Obama administration through the Trump presidency and now with the Biden administration.
When the Biden administration came into office, President Biden set a target of 125,000 refugees. Now, it takes a while to get up to that target of 125,000 refugees. But then, with the Afghanistan evacuation, we needed to have the capacity to resettle 72,000 over 5 months. Our network had only resettled 11,000 a year for the previous 2 years under the previous administration. So we needed to be able to build up the capacity overnight.
It's interesting. I mean, we see the persistent desire of people at the southern border to seek asylum in the United States, and they're often turned back and made to wait for years. And then we see a very quick response to resettle Afghans and Ukrainians. Explain for our listeners who see that disparity, why do some people get immediate help and others don't?
Those who are coming or requesting asylum at the southern border are a different category of immigrants. Refugees are given refugee status overseas before they come into the country. Asylum seekers, while it's the same definition to receive asylum as it is for refugees, asylum is given after they have arrived in the United States and they request asylum and go through the process. Our program focuses on those who are given refugee status overseas. It can take years and years for them to be able to receive this status. And in fact, of the 100 million people that for the first time in history have been identified as forcibly displaced, less than 1% of that population is resettled in a third country such as the United States. So it's a very, very small number that you see. We talk about the Ukrainians coming to the United States, but we all see on the news the millions of people who are in other countries around the world. So the refugee resettlement program is a smaller program. It is intending to be developed and the capacity expanded, but it is still a much smaller program than the number of people around the world who are in need of protection.
Holly Herrera is Domestic Resettlement Chief of the Office of Refugee Admission at the State Department. She was speaking to us about the global needs during World Refugee Week. When I think of frogs, I think of two things, those springy leaps and that classic croak. But the world's Bianca Hillier brings us this tale of a tiny Brazilian frog that just doesn't fit that mold.
They're called pumpkin toadlets, and like their name suggests, most of them are orange. Bright orange.
They're cute frogs. They're just adorable.
Rick Essner is a zoology professor at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville. He says pumpkin toadlets have a cartoonish look with
big black eyes and kind of a grumpy looking face.
Basically, they're perfect for the internet. But if you blink, you might just miss them.
They are really tiny. The smallest one that I worked with was about the size of a housefly.
Essner says some are bigger, if you consider a centimeter to be big. This itty-bitty size is charming, sure, but it leads to one problem. Pumpkin toadlets are the worst jumpers of all the frogs Essner has ever seen.
It's quite impressive how bad their landings are.
Their landings are so bad that people on the internet have put videos of them to epic fail music. Upon takeoff, everything seems fine. Their hind legs launch them into the sky. But midair, things go awry. The pumpkin toadlets freeze. Their limbs straighten. Their whole body stiffens. And like a crash dummy, they fall pitifully to the ground. These landings are the subject of Essner's recent studies, which he conducted with a team of international researchers. He says it's not a cognitive issue, but a balance one.
When the semicircular canals of the inner ear gets really small, it doesn't function as well. And the animals use that information to control their posture in midair.
pumpkin toadlets aren't getting that information, so they just stay in their launch position until gravity finishes the job. Don't worry, Essner says no toadlets are harmed during these failed jumps.
Small things typically don't have problems with breaking bones or doing damage.
Just like squirrels can fall out of a tree and be on their merry way. As for pumpkin toadlets, they mostly crawl around the forest floor. They only attempt jumps as a last resort to escape predators. Essner knows these little guys are more than endearing and hilarious to watch. They're also relatable.
You see an animal like that that doesn't do athletics very well, that might strike a chord. At least in my case, it reminds me of myself in gym class.
Next up, Essner and his team want to study juvenile pumpkin toadlets. They're even smaller than their housefly-sized parents, and I'm sure, even cuter. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
A clumsy, tiny frog that doesn't know how to jump? Yes, of course we have a video for you. Check out our Twitter feed. We are at The World. June is Pride Month in the U.S. Pride celebrations happened in about half the world's countries last year, and the group Outright Action International has analyzed these celebrations in a new report. Joining us now from Washington is the report's lead researcher, Neela Ghoshal. Neela, June is Pride Month in the U.S., but is it celebrated at different times around the world?
Yes, June is Pride Month in the U.S., and because Pride Month is something that has spread around the world since its founding in the U.S. in 1970, in many countries around the world, Pride Month is held in June, but in other countries, it's held at completely different times of year. We have to keep in mind that in the Southern Hemisphere, the warmer months are during November, December, January, February, and so a lot of activists choose to hold Pride marches outside during those warmer months. At the moment, I have on my calendar Pride events happening in July, in October, in December, in different parts of the world.
This is your organization's second report looking at global Pride celebrations. Were there any big changes between the two reports?
2021 was a year in which, of course, COVID lockdowns and COVID restrictions were continuing in many countries around the world. The previous report looked at events over the last several years between 2018 and 2020. And so we were actually really surprised to find that in 2021, there were 107 countries in which we were able to document Pride events taking place. And this means that activists were not held back by COVID restrictions, found ways to adapt to them, and also in some cases moved Pride online. We also saw new countries that were holding Pride for the first time.
I was going to ask about that, whether there were any first Pride celebrations in 2021.
Yes, there were several. A couple of them that the report discusses in detail are in Malawi and in Rwanda. Now, in the African context, it's much more difficult for activists to hold Pride events, even in countries where same-sex relations are not technically against the law. So in more than half of African countries, including Malawi, same-sex conduct is criminalized. And yet Malawian activists for the first time in 2021 said, we're going out to the streets. They had held events during Pride Month before, but they had held inside events that were for the community itself or for known allies. And last year, they said, we're fed up with remaining in the closet and we're going into the streets.
Did things go well or did they meet with any difficulty?
Well, they certainly met with difficulty. We were just hearing from an activist who spoke in our event today, launching the report. And he said that after the event, participants received death threats. Some of them had their houses vandalized. Some of the organizations had threats at their offices. So clearly there was an intent, not necessarily from government authorities itself, but from members of the public to intimidate those who'd had the audacity to come out and march in the streets in Malawi. And of course, the challenge is when LGBTIQ activists in Malawi are receiving threats from members of the public, if they go to the police and report those threats, they're not going to get a whole lot of support. And in fact, they risk being arrested themselves. And yet this year in 2022, they just went ahead 2 weeks ago and held their second Pride event. There was a core of activists that was willing to go out in the streets again, make themselves public, and also issue a petition of demands to the government, including around the decriminalization of same-sex conduct.
Ultimately, what impact can these Pride events have on the societies in which they take place?
We surveyed activists in advance of the publication of this report about the reasons why they do Pride and what they hope to accomplish and what impact they hope to have on other people. And interestingly, the things that we heard from activists were fairly consistent the world over, both in countries in which there is official legal equality under the law and in countries in which LGBTIQ people remain criminalized. And first and foremost, what we heard was no matter where people were, they continued to feel that it was pressing that the general public know and understand that LGBTIQ people exist and that LGBTIQ people are everywhere.
Are Pride events a good barometer for progress on LGBTQ rights?
I would say that Pride events are one of many barometers of progress on LGBTIQ rights. And I say one of many because, of course, visibility is extremely important. And we also know that when governments successfully shut down Pride events, that they are blocking one of our main channels of building progress and building support. Queer people need allies, and they need allies to understand. We need allies to understand that we exist and what our demands are for basic human rights. And so part of what Pride events do is build empathy. Those who see LGBTIQ people march in the streets, who understand why we're marching, begin to empathize with our causes and begin to join our parades and our events as allies.
Neela Ghoshal is the Senior Director of Law, Policy, and Research at Outright Action International. She's been speaking to us from Washington. Neela, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
For the past few years, music festival lovers have had a rough go.
From Coachella to Glastonbury to the Avignon Theatre Festival and the Edinburgh Festival.
Vegas has been canceled.
Canceling this year's activities because of coronavirus.
In the Balkans, the Sunny Hill Festival in the state of Kosovo was no exception. It's the country's first major music festival. Back in 2019, fans from across the globe came to see pop star Dua Lipa. The British Albanian singer wasn't just another name on the international lineup. Dua Lipa runs the show with her Kosovo-born dad, Dukagjin Lipa. He says the show's mission is to promote Kosovo as an international cultural hub. This year, the festival is back on, but the location has been up in the air. In a letter to Kosovo's prime minister last week, Dukagjin Lipa wrote that the festival has been politicized, and authorities hadn't given them permission to host the festival in Kosovo's capital, Pristina. Dukagjin Lipa pleaded his case that the festival raises money for the local economy and promotes Kosovo's culture. Still, he did what he had to do. So instead of staging the event in Lipa's homeland, the 2022 Sunny Hill Festival was moved to neighboring Albania. Dukagjin Lipa said it was tough to move the festival away, but this week, some good news. Officials agreed to move the concert back to Kosovo's capital. An advisor to Kosovo's president said Dua Lipa is Kosovo's ambassador to the world. And now the festival can be, quote, back where it belongs in early August. Diplo will take the stage along with Kosovar artists Kida, Gisi, and DJ Regard. Welcome news for music fans in Kosovo, but don't feel too bad for Albania. A special edition of the festival with a different lineup will be held in Albania a few weeks later. More music all around, a positive thing. We leave you today with that good thought. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.
One last note before we go. The daily coverage you rely on from The World, whether it's the podcast, broadcast, or at theworld.org, it's available for everyone for free thanks to listener support. We're coming to the end of our fundraiser on June 30th. If you've been thinking about donating but just haven't done it yet, please make your gift today. It only takes a minute, but it helps our entire team to produce the show every day. Every single gift will help us reach our goal of raising $25,000. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.